chapter 17 and 18 are essentially one element. Chapter 17 deals with the destruction of ecclesiastical Babylon, or if you like, religious Babylon, and during the tribulation period. And chapter 18, which we'll do next week, describes the destruction of political Babylon. I think what I'll do is jump to the end, tell you the end of the story at the start, so that you got some kind of a thing to aim towards. We've looked so far at this back in chapter 13 as the revived Roman Empire. The revived Roman Empire, of course, we get our foundational basis for that is back in Daniel chapter 7 and 8. And back in that chapter, what we find is the image of the beast, the image that this horrible big image that Daniel sees, and it's got various metals. The legs are made of iron, which is predictive of the Roman Empire that crushes everybody in its path. And then the feet and the toes are iron mixed with clay. And that's the revived Roman Empire. It doesn't have quite the same characteristic as the Roman Empire did back in the days of Christ. So we have the revived Roman Empire, and what we'll see as we work our way through this passage is that the revived Roman Empire and those who dominate it actually gives way to a worldwide empire with one ruler. No prizes for guessing. So with that sort of, in your mind, let's start to work through the verses and we'll see how we go. So John received this revelation in chapter 17 and 18. Again, the book is not sequential. The book is not chronological. What we've been looking at in last week in Romans, in Revelation 16, is preceded by a significant amount of time by 17 and 18. In point of fact, most commentators believe that the events of chapter 17, which we'll get tonight, pretty much took place around the midpoint of the tribulation, when the Antichrist goes into the temple and demands to be worshipped as God. Daniel referred to it, and Christ referred to it as the abomination of desolation, and what an abomination that was. So here's the verses in verse 17, verse 1. And there came one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, come hither, I will show unto you the judgment of the great whore that sits upon many waters. Now let's just pick it apart. This is all about false religion. Okay. The great whore, is a reference to spiritual Babylon. Or to the religion of Babylon, and we'll look at that in a bit more detail a little bit later. And it's the spiritual Babylon is always pictured as a woman, and here she's referred to as a great whore, which is probably not very complimentary, but there you are. And she sits upon many waters. In other words, she dominates. This great whore, this apostate religion, dominates many nations, and the word waters is referring to nations, as we've seen previously in Revelation. Then verse 2 says, with whom the kings of the earth And we'll see more of those, more about the kings of the earth in a moment. So I won't say too much about them right now, but with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. And the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. It's interesting to note that the phrase you see there, have committed fornication, is past tense. And it's also in what's called the aorist form. In Greek, it's the aorist form of the verb. It's a single word in Greek, but it's translated have committed fornication. And the significance of it being an aorist form is that it has happened with certainty. There's no question about the fact that it happened. It's happened in the past, but the actual time is not specified. So that's why that is that's significant. This church is one that's professing godliness, but denies the very power of Yahweh, who they purport to represent. It's an apostate church. I believe it's represented today by the World Council of Churches and the Ecumenical Movement. It's a false religion. It's an apostate church, and it's the enemy of true religion. You know why it's the enemy of true religion, friends? When somebody comes along, is the darkness on the right side of my face distracting to anybody? I can turn another light on if it's bothering anyone. Okay. The reason that it's dangerous is because these are the very places where people go, and we have them come to Haddon, and they've been going to church for years and years and years and years. And yet, no one has ever spoken to them, nor have they ever heard the message of the good news of the gospel, that those who call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. It's looked upon as slaughterhouse religion. It's old-fashioned. And in case you think that it's far distant from us, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, 50% of the pastors in the Victorian and Tasmanian Churches of Christ said they didn't think that the preaching of the gospel was adequate in today's age to bring people to faith in God. Says it all. So this is the apostate church, and we'll look a little bit more at that as we get down to verse 8 and start getting in over our head. Verse 3. So he carried me away in the spirit. Now, I want you to see here, in probably in your Bibles, it says, so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness. The word "the" would be a definite article, and it's not there in the Greek. So, well, how it should read is, so he carried me away in the spirit into wilderness. It's clumsy, and that's why the translators have actually put in the definite article to make it read better in English, but it's not there in Greek, and it's worth noting. So he carried me away in the spirit into wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-coloured beast full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Notice her posture, and this is a present tense participle. This is a strong, very, very strong language. And it says she's sitting on the beast. The indication here is that she's drawing this apostate church is drawing her power and drawing her authority, not from God, but from the beast, but from Satan. And it says that he saw him sit upon the scarlet-coloured beast, full of names of blasphemy. This is exactly the same image that we see in Revelation 13 and verse 1, where the revived Roman Empire is presented as the centre of world government. And we'll see this is also the centre of apostate world religion. It says in verse 4, and the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colour and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, but what's in it? It's full of the abominations and filthiness of her fornication. This is about doctrine. This is about teaching, which is not according to godliness. It's blasphemy. It's blasphemous teaching. Basically, this golden cup is nothing more than showboating, pomp and ceremony. And when you actually look at this, one commentator said this is typical of the Roman and Greek Orthodox garb that you see in their parades that they have at Easter time and one thing and another. This is exactly what they look like, exactly how they present themselves. But you're not going to hear the gospel come from that crowd. And verse 5 says, and upon her forehead was a name. This is the woman sitting on the beast. Upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots, and abominations of the earth. Oh. So let me just try and unpack that for you a little bit. If I don't know about your Bible, in my Bible it's in capital letters. And this finds its foundation all the way back in Genesis. Way, way back in Genesis chapter 11. And in Genesis chapter 11, we find the story of Nimrod and the Tower of Babel. Now, I want you to just get that correct. This business of building mud brick, creating mud brick structures, reaching as high as they could possibly get, the purpose of which was to impress the people around them and to supplant the power of God with the power of man. Blasphemy. Right from the word go, it was blasphemy. And there's lots of these little towers, but the Tower of Babel was under Nimrod, was much more spectacular. Here we see the beginning of the foundational structure of the apostate church and the church that is committing fornication and adultery and is filthy and disgusting in the eyes of God. And so we start out with Babel, and Babel, the Tower of Babel, is where Babylon was built. You see? So Babel morphed into Babylon. And of course, Babylon had massive statues, massive, enormous, huge statues. And they were all in dedication to the demonic god Bel, B-E-L. So you come along there, and there was just these enormous statues, and of course the key element of that statue was the lion, and of course the lion was typical of great strength and typical of generating great fear into the hearts of people, and so we find Babylon, and then as we come down, we find elements of this Babylonian blasphemy through the life of Israel over and over and over again. And the prophets railed on it. Over and over, the prophets railed on this Babylonian elements of demonic religion. And one of the worst aspects of it all was the Jews intermarrying with the pagans around them, strictly against the word, the Torah. And you find Ezra and Nehemiah railing on the people about this is being wrong. And then as you work through the minor prophets, the so-called minor prophets, as they ministered to Israel from the time of the people coming back from Babylon, right through until the end of Malachi, over and over they railed against and they called out these practices, these religious practices that had come from Babylon, that had come from Babylon and originally from Baal. And one of those awful practices was the practices of Molech, where they would build an enormous fire underneath this horrible looking thing with its arms, its iron, made out of iron that would become glowing white hot. And they would bring and sacrifice their firstborn child by throwing them into the arms of this thing, and they'd just literally be dead and evaporated, you know, in no time flat. This is the sort of disgusting stuff that goes on. And the interesting thing is that it involved the prophets of Baal. And the worship of Baal, and the worship of Baal was a highly sexualized so-called worship. And it's interesting that we see that the kings of the earth have committed fornication. And we see the connection in the wording even here in the book of Revelation. And we get all the way through to Ephesus and Corinth, where the local religion was, number one, it was emperor worship, and number two, it was again from the shreds of Baal, it was highly sexualized worship, where they would go and have intercourse with prostitutes, male and female, as part of the temple worship of the area. And you see the Apostle Paul, in his teaching, comes down on it like a ton of bricks. One of the interesting things about the people in Corinth that had to be corrected was they went too far the other way, and they said, we want to limit our sexual relationship to just simply reproducing, to producing babies, and apart from that, to abstain. And the Apostle Paul comes down on top of them and says, no, this doesn't mean you abstain from having sexual intercourse, because if you abstain, the devil will tempt you. So you should be having a dynamic sexual relationship within marriage. And he encourages those people in Corinth to get that attitude right. And others, he's saying, you shouldn't be messing around with this other stuff. So they were a messed up church. I've heard some idiot preachers refer to them as a spirit-filled church at Corinth. What a joke that is. Read through 1 Corinthians. You won't find much spirit-filled behavior going on in Corinth, at least not in 1 Corinthians. So that brings us up to the connection now to the first century church, and then of course in the second century, along came Constantine, and he declared Christianity to be the state religion. But he brought into that all this paganism that was brought into it that goes all the way back to the Babylonish state and to Babel. And that was right from the word go, the formation of Roman Catholicism was based on an unholy communication of paganism and Christianity. And that's where a lot of these, right through to today, some of these horrifying doctrines that they have, it's a mess. And so what we'll see here, as we just press on, I need to give you all that background so you can understand the next, as we go into the next verse. In verse 6, John says, I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered. Now, in my Bible, it says, I wonder with great admiration. The word is astonishment. It was, you have to be kidding me, type of a reaction. Now, if you want to just simply look at what was happening here, she's drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And up to this point in human history, from the year AD 70 until now, the organization that has persecuted and violently murdered more Christians than anybody else is the Roman Catholic Church. They have relentlessly pursued anybody who held any opinion other than their own, and whether you know it or whether you're aware of it or not, for centuries. They fought and fought and fought to stop the Bible being put into the hands of the common people in the common language. And the brave guys like Jan Hus, the Bohemian, and others, some other English guys as well, some of these guys put the Bible into the English language, and they paid by being burned at the stake for doing it. So it's a terrifying history, and it leads up to this. And he says, in verse 6, he says, I wondered with great astonishment about this. And verse 7 says, and the angel said to me, wherefore did you marvel? Why are you astonished? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carrieth her, which has the seven heads and ten horns. Oh, thank God for this verse. The angel makes us a promise. He said, I'm going to tell you what it means. Oh, I wrote it in my Bible. Wonderful. Thank you, Lord. I put that next to that verse. And so that's the easy part of the chapter. You okay? Oh, dear. So take a deep breath and we'll move on. In verse 8 verse 8, something else. So it says, the beast that you saw was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. The beast that you saw was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit. And will go into perdition. So he'll end up in the lake of fire. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, it says, they shall be in astonished awe, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is. And of course, we're now speaking about the Antichrist. Spiritual wisdom is required to understand how this fits together, and we'll just press on and hope we don't lose anybody. And here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Okay. So let me make a blunt statement, and then I'll read you something. This is a reference to Rome. there's no question this is a reference to Rome. Nobody seriously doubts, no commentators seriously doubt that that's what this is, that this is the center of world ecclesiastical power. But it's referred to, many times it's referred to as Babylon, not as meaning the city of Babylon in Iraq, but meaning the filthy, rotten religious practices of Babylon, which have been adopted by the church at Rome. That's what it's referring to. And I'll just read this to you. I don't normally read stuff out, but I think this is important. It says, the seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. Many expositors refer this to Rome. Seven hills form the nucleus of the ancient city on the left bank of the Tiber River. These hills receive the names of Palatine, Aventine, Cilian, Esquiline, Viminal, Quirinal, and Capitoline. So each of these seven hills had their own name. And this passage in Revelation is taken, therefore, to indicate that the seat of ecclesiastical or religious power will be in Rome geographically rather than in Babylon. Throughout its history, Rome has been described as the city of seven hills, as indicated in coins, Roman coins, which they minted, which refer to it in this way, and in countless allusions in Roman literature. Victorinus, one of the first to write a commentary on the book of Revelation, identified the seven mountains as the city of Rome hundreds of years ago. And so that sort of positions you with that all that background, all that history from Babel all the way through. You can see how it's evolved through into what it is right now. And then verse 9 says, and here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings. Five are fallen. Five are gone. They're dead. One is at the time of, was contemporary with John. And the other is not yet come. And when he comes, he must continue for a short space. Don't confuse that. Too many expositors have confused he which must come and continue for a short space with the Antichrist. It's not the Antichrist. This is in fact another ruler, a world ruler, who is yet to appear. And verse 11 makes this clear, that and the beast, in other words, the Antichrist, and the beast that was and is not even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goes into perdition. Now, I'm just going to read verses 12 and 13, come back and explain it. And the ten horns which thou saw are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. In other words, for a short time. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Now, I want you to think of it this way. We have a prime minister, and all the states have premiers. God knows we've become aware of those guys in the last couple of years. So, while the PM, while the prime minister has authority over the nation, premiers only have authority over a state. And that's what these kings are in these ten horns here. It says they are ten kings which have received no kingdom. They are in fact energized by, authorized by, and permitted by the Antichrist to run sections of his kingdom. Makes sense. But he's the world ruler. He's the ruler overall. If you can get that mental picture of that structure, you can understand this okay. These guys are all of one mind, and they give their power and strength to the beast. So there's no room here. It's not like here in Australia, where you have a national cabinet, and they all agree to something and then go away and do something different. Nothing like that. They don't actually make decisions. The beast makes the decisions. They put them into place. They're kings. They're rulers without a kingdom. That's what that means. And verse 14 says, these shall make war with the Lamb. And now we switch now to what they're doing is they're bringing the armies of the world together for the battle of Armageddon. It says, and these shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called chosen and faithful, and that's you. That is you. We are the ones, and all the other believers in the of past and present and future, we are the ones who are being referred to here as those who have been called and chosen. Now, you could camp on that word called for five messages, and you'll end up coming out the other end of Calvinist. But the point is here that God, in God's foreknowledge, he knew that the least barter would call upon the name of the Lord and be saved. And he knew that other people wouldn't. He didn't choose people for hell and choose people for heaven. That's not what this is about. This is about his foreknowledge of knowing how individuals will react. And we're called chosen and faithful. And he said unto me, the waters which you saw where the whore sits, and here it is, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. You go back to the very beginning, it says that the great whore is sitting upon many waters. And I said to you, then that's nations. And here it is here, spelled out for us, that it's nations, it's peoples, it's multitudes of nations and tongues. This is not something that happens in the Middle East, friends. This is global. This is the every square inch of the globe is involved in this. And he says, and the ten horns, and they're ruled by the Antichrist. And the ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore. Now all of a sudden, we have a right-hand turn. Remember we saw the whore sitting upon the beast, drawing her power from the beast in a big apostate world religion, right around the middle of the tribulation period. The devil has no more use for that, because from here on in, it's going to be a political movement, and the religious movement has done its job by drawing people in to the point of worshiping him and taking his mark on their forehead. There's no reason to have them anymore, to have the false prophet and this religion anymore. And it says here, and the ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. The destruction, what you're seeing there is the destruction of the apostate church centered in Rome. And verse 17, for God has put in their hearts to fulfill his will. You got to love this. But this apostate religion is a stench in the nostrils of God. And it's God's will for them to be destroyed. And who does he use to destroy them? He uses the devil who used them. He doesn't even use his own people. And the ten horns which thou shall make are desolate and naked, for God, verse 17, for God hath put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God be fulfilled. Whole time God's pulling the strings, men. The devil thinks he's in charge. God's pulling the strings. Brilliant. And we finish up tonight here with verse 18. And the woman which and the woman which thou sawest is that great city which sits on seven hills. The woman which you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. She reigned over the kings of the earth. There was a spiritual, religious reigning over all of the earth, over the kings of the earth, meaning over the nations of the earth, one church worldwide. One church worldwide. A one world church. You can see it forming in this dreadful ecumenical movement. Okay, so I'll draw a line under it right there and take any questions. Lord knows I probably won't be able to answer them, but I'll give it a shot.
So, Neil, you're saying around about the mid tribulation mark that the false prophet will just be basically shoved over.
No, that wouldn't be correct. The false prophet is certainly using using the apostate world church, and once Satan has no further use for that, that gets scuttlebutted, because from that point forward, he wants to be worshipped, and he becomes the object of the worship of mankind. And they're wearing the mark on his forehead. And if they don't worship him, well, they will, because they've bought into it completely. Yeah, very good. Good question. Anybody else?
I have another question.
Of course you do.
the seven...
Quite aside from the 10 questions I'll get on the email tomorrow.
You're not doing anything anymore, are you?
No. Robin and I are just, we're kicking back, man. Yeah.
the kings, the seven kings, that five that have fallen, one is known to John, he's a contemporary, and the other is yet to come. Do we know, can we place those kings?
No, not that I'm aware of. I've never seen in any of the studies that I have done. These are basically would be considered insignificant individuals.
Yeah.
Mm. And the one that is to come will be a world leader who brings about this whole one world economy and one world religion thing. He will certainly be fostering that, but it doesn't identify who that might be. I've got one more thing to tell you tonight, but I want to finish up with questions first. So has anybody else got a question you'd like to pose or ask? Comments?
Excuse me, Neil. Just wanted to clarify in verse 10, it says he must, and when he comes, he must continue a short time. So that's just what you said.
Yeah.
It's a fellow that's going to come before...
Right.
The Antichrist.
And not for long.
Okay.
Because the Antichrist doesn't want to give his glory to anybody else. I want to draw your attention to a phrase in this passage. It says, he no longer is, and yet he'll come. And then it says he'll go into perdition. It specifically uses the word perdition. And I think that's a very interesting word. Now, I'm not going to say to you, not at all, I'm not going to say to you that what I'm about to tell you is absolute biblical truth, and I'm going to, you know, die for it. But I think that there's enough evidence here to raise the issue that the Antichrist may very well be the resurrection of Judas Iscariot. And one of the reasons that I say that is because there's things said about Judas Iscariot that aren't said about any other human being in the Bible. And one of those things is that it says that after he died, he went to his own place. He didn't go to Sheol. There's nothing about him going to where everybody else goes, and he goes to his own place. And the interesting thing is that Jesus actually referred to him as the son of perdition.
Mm.
And he uses the exact same Greek word that appears here in Revelation. There's a number of other peculiar things about him. As a case in point, when he left the upper room, it says that Satan entered into him. Nowhere else in the scripture, and you can hunt from top to bottom, but nowhere else in the scripture does it say that Satan himself entered into any man. Demons did. There's lots of examples of demons entering into mankind, but not actually Satan himself entering into man. And when we get into we did a study on Thessalonians, and in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it refers there to Satan performing all forms of miracles and lying wonders.
Mm.
All forms. He has limited power. He has power limited by God himself, but his power is pretty spectacular. So while I'm not going to come out and say to you tonight, the Antichrist is Judas Iscariot raised from the dead, there are some peculiar things about Judas Iscariot, and it's just eternity will tell the story, of course. But I will say this to you, and I know there's been a bit of a movement amongst evangelicals away from this, but I think it's quite wrong. The Antichrist has really got to be Jewish.
Mm, yeah.
And the reason he has to be Jewish, there's a very powerful argument for the fact he has to be Jewish, is because the Jews trust no one outside of their own. And a league is going to be created, a covenant is going to be created, which allows the Jews to rebuild their temple, to bowl over that Mosque of Omar thing, and to rebuild the Temple of Solomon on the Temple Mount. That's a Jewish thing to do. And they already have their plans in place, and they're all ready to go. So there's some really interesting things there. We're just speculating right now. And as I said, I'm not going to tell you this is gospel truth, but it's something interesting for you to think about. And, if you want to do a search, if you go and do a search on Google, you'll find there's lots of guys commenting on this and raising that issue as a possibility. The thing that I take great comfort in, as I look at all of that, thank God I'm not going to be part of that.
Mm.
I'm not going to be subjected to that, because by his grace and mercy, he called me out of darkness into light, and I'm delivered from that.
Mm.
Which is really such a wonderful thing, eh?